Great. So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's August 7th, 2013, and I want to pick up the thread from last week. If you were here, I sort of just ad-libbed it about peace, and I was moved in that direction. I was feeling very peaceful, and I just kind of went for it. And tonight I'd like to expand on that and talk about enjoying four kinds of peace, and then open it up and see what you feel about this and think about it. You may know that in Buddhism, tranquility, which I spoke of in the suggestions for the meditation tonight, is considered to be one of the seven factors of enlightenment, one of the seven factors of awakening. Tranquility, a kind of peacefulness in the body, a peacefulness around desires, a relatively peaceful mind, tranquility. It's also said that, as the Buddha put it, the highest happiness is peace. So peace is very valued there. And then you can think of the ways in which peace and various connotations or flavors is woven into Buddhist morality around non-harming, being at peace with others, right speech, for example, wise speech, keep a peaceful tongue in your head, as it were, a civil tongue, and, admonitions like give others no cause to fear you. They may have cause to expect consequences. If they don't pay their rent, you may need to evict them eventually or something like that. But that's really different from, being at war with other people. So peace is an overarching value. And you can imagine the peace that comes when we crave less or cling less. There's a kind of peacefulness there. Or we interact with other people in a way that doesn't create ill will or difficulty or contentiousness or quarrels and so forth. Peace is a value. So I wanted to talk about what are, for me at least, four kinds of peace. This is not a list extracted from the Buddha. Its merits or demerits are entirely my own. Judge for yourself, as the Buddha said famously. See for yourself, ehi pasiko, what's useful to you or not. So when I think about peace in terms of the first kind, I'll call it the peace of ease. And by the way, I'm going to move through these four, particularly by the time I get to the fourth, into some fairly, for me at least, profound territory. So the first kind of peace is the peace of ease. It's the peace of drinking water when we're thirsty, the peace of coming to a kind of resolution with someone that we've had a conversation with or a difficulty with, the peace in finishing a project that's been looming over us, the peace of sitting outside and relaxing and going, whew, that kind of peace, everyday peace, ordinary peace, and yet very important peace. The peace in experiencing that our three fundamental needs are being basically met. Our needs for safety, for fulfillment, satisfaction, rewards of various kinds, and our need for connection with other people. Things don't need to be perfect, and yet there's still a meaningful and important peace. A peace when finally the dog stops barking next door. A peace finally when your partner stops snoring and you can fall asleep, A peace when you finally make it to the bathroom, if you're stuck on an airplane a long time. Whatever that peace may be. It's an important peace. It's a peace that counts, okay? That's the first kind of peace. The second kind of peace in my structure here, my framework, see for yourself, is the peace of tranquility. This is a relatively non-ordinary, and yet in some sense still conventional peace. Maybe we're just sitting there in the backyard and everything's done, it's all right. Maybe we hear the children playing in the distance and they're fine for once, We don't have anything else to do that matters. We're just, and some deep tranquility comes over us. The body just lets go. There's no disturbance in the mind. Tranquility. Or maybe we're camping. We see a lake, say, in the mountain. The surface is perfectly still. And that sort of draws us, the stillness of the lake draws us into a similar psychological stillness. Or perhaps you're doing a practice here or in your own meditation practice elsewhere where you follow the Buddha's suggestion to tranquilize the bodily formations, where you relax the body and the body gets very, very tranquil. Breath gets more and more shallow. I sensed that a fair number of people were able to move into a growing tranquility, the territory really of this factor of awakening. A little bit later in the 16 steps of the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta, we got through the first four and it was already pretty deep, he talks about tranquilizing the reaction to the pleasantness, unpleasantness, or neutrality of experiences, relaxing or tranquilizing the feeling tone, the hedonic tone in psychology. And a little later as well, he talks about tranquilizing perception, how we label things, how we think about them, or categorize them in one way or another. So there are even further kinds of tranquility. But minimally, we can, I think all of us, one way or another, experience a state of deep tranquility that's not a common experience unless we cultivate it quite significantly, and yet it's quite accessible to us. Okay, so that's the second kind of peace that we can enjoy. And enjoy is a really important word, because through enjoying it, we'll be motivated in this direction. We also, why not? We'll reap the rewards of our practice. And in enjoying it, it'll help it sink in. We'll take in the good of this experience of the peace of ease or the peace of tranquility or the other two I'm about to get to. And through enjoying them and therefore taking in the good, they become increasingly the habit of our brain. We build structure in our brain. And that becomes increasingly the inclination of our mind. Okay? So two down and two to go. All right? Third kind of peace is enjoying the peace of awareness, awareness itself. And here I don't mean anything like cosmic consciousness. I don't mean anything metaphysical. And yet I do mean something that's not an ordinary kind of recognition. For example, you may have a sense of a kind of perspective inside. People use different terms for this, like the witness, or the fair witness, or the knowing, right? And this witnessing itself is untroubled by what it witnesses. Like, I don't know about you, I've had experiences where I was in a situation of one kind or another and I was upset, and I became aware that there was a part of me, I'm not even sure it was me in any ordinary sense, but a part of me that was observing what was happening without being troubled by it. It was maybe taking notes or just seeing what was going to happen, but it itself felt very neutral about what it was seeing. You know, it had a compassionate quality, which is interesting. It doesn't feel like cold or metallic. There was a kind of warmth or compassion in it, but fundamentally an untroubled witnessing. So that's one way to experience and enjoy, hopefully, the peace of awareness. We could take refuge in that witnessing, and even find peace in the fact that we can take refuge in it. So that's one way to enjoy, to experience and enjoy the peace of awareness. A second way is to become aware of the space between the thoughts, or the space between the sounds or other contents of mind. And I'll share with you a little technique that Ajahn Sumedho, a Western monk, very senior, now semi-retired, once he was asked in an interview what he did in his own meditation practice, Ajahn Sumedho. And this is an American who went to, I think, Thailand and so forth in the 50s and so forth. He said, well, honestly, I no longer distinguish between meditation and any other state of mind. Like, whoa. And he wasn't meaning that, well, when I meditate, I'm distracted and working on my shopping list, you know, like my ordinary state of mind. For him, there just wasn't that distinction. So he said, you know, you can do this little practice if you like. Deliberately think a thought. And the one he used is diabolical in a very monastically well-intended way. He says, think the thought, I am not enlightened. And because then he challenges that, really? But in any case, think any kind of a thought. You know, the grass is green. Or I am fine. Any kind of thought. And try to notice a certain roughly half second or so space just before or after it. And you'll discern a sort of fertile capacity to represent thought, but no thought itself. It's kind of weirdly quiet in the grout between the tiles of the mind, right? The mosaic of the mind, think about the grout between the tiles. That's another way to access and enjoy the piece of awareness itself. There is an ongoingness, a capacity, a presence, but there's no content in that little sliver, and you can have a momentary perception of that tranquility, really, that peacefulness of awareness itself. That's another way into that. And a larger point, which is illustrated right here, is that especially as we move more into the second, the third and fourth kinds of peace I'm talking about, in the beginning especially, it could be more conceptual or very fleeting as an experience. And that's really okay. It's okay to deepen the conceptual understanding of this kind of peace. And it's okay to, as they say in Tibet, you know, sudden awakening many times a day. And the sudden awakening could be 3/4 of a second experientially. And that's okay. Because it can build conviction that, wow, it really is like that. And it counts. In other words, it's not like we're failed Dharma students or spiritual practitioners because we can't sustain it. It really counts that we had a flash in that moment. There was a truth there that later we're remembering, but in the moment, our experience was valid. And this applies all the way through these practices, especially the third and the fourth. A third way to enjoy the peace of awareness, it requires a little bit of a conceptual framework here. At least this is how I do it. And experientially, how it feels, before I get into the conceptual part, is that you're in the moment in your experience. It helps if experience is relatively quiet, like meditating or just kind of hanging out on the subway or just sort of rocking a baby or, you know, stirring the spaghetti sauce, what have you. And in the moment, you're aware of your experience and you start becoming aware of the constructing of it or the emerging of it, that the appearing of it. In other words, you start becoming, you become less aware of the nouns and more aware of the verbs. What I mean is less aware of the content and the generating of experience. And you start getting this intuition, which can often be very brief, and then it comes again, that the awaring of the contents of the mind, the awaring of sounds, of sights, of smells, or feelings, or thoughts, or desires, or just the chatter in the head, the awaring of that is itself undisturbable. It's not affected by what it represents. And neurologically, the underpinnings of conscious experience are understood kind of at a deep architecture. They're not well understood at all in the transition from the neural activity to subjective experience, such as the sense of the color red, you know, or the smell of an orange. But deeper down, they're increasingly, kind of remarkably, understood what it takes to wake us up, put us to sleep, anesthetize us, bring us back from anesthesia, states of consciousness, and all the rest of that. And the basic idea is that as a conscious experience forms, let's think of something simple, you know, a sound occurs. The first tenth of a second, there's a kind of alerting response. Something has happened. Within the second and third tenths of a second, there's an orienting to it, like it's over there, and the beginning of a labeling of it. By the third or fourth or fifth tenth of a second, imagine a coalition of millions, literally, of little synapses, little junctions. You could put 5,000 of them side by side in the width of a human hair, a single human hair. Little junctions are syncing up with each other to be the hardware that represents the information of that sound. The sound as sensation, as well as a growing kind of labeling, door opening, or corn, or car honking, or cough, right? And then this coalition stabilizes. So you imagine it's a little bit like millions of synapses all raising their hands and clapping in unison. That's the coalition. And we know it's that coalition because they're clapping at this rhythm rather than this rhythm. That coalition lasts for a few more seconds, and then it decays. It disorganizes. It organizes initially. There's a reduction of uncertainty, therefore an increase in information. This is the underpinning of a conscious experience. And then the coalition decays, and those individual synapses, those little clappers, become available for another content and awareness, another sight, another thought, another feeling, another plan. It's a little bit like an eddy in a stream. Coming together, self-organizes, it stabilizes, and then swirls away. That's how it works. It's kind of wild to think about it. And that understanding that also fuels disenchantment, which is highly valued, as you probably know in Buddhism, because it's kind of hard to take your own trip that seriously when you realize what the neural underpinnings of it are. All right? So now here's the point. For these synapses to be able to come together to represent that new event, there had to be a prior unused capacity. Right? Now, when synapses are not being used to represent something coherent, you know, where there's a reduction of uncertainty and an increase of information, thus an experience, right? A signal, a meaning, a plan, an instruction, right? Those synapses, a lot of them are pretty quiet, although they're still doing stuff. You know, they're building their little molecular structures, they're changing, they're getting metabolized back into the individual neuron, and a lot they're firing with each other. A typical neuron is firing 5 to 50 times a second. A lot of that neural firing is just noise. It's fertile noise. It's like chaos just waiting to be ordered. Now, in a larger sense, it is conditioned in the sense that evolution and the demands of the nervous system create conditions. But inside that condition, those wide parameters, it's just noise. It's fertile noise waiting to be enlisted into a coalition that's a reduction of noise, an increase in information, thus the experience of the bell ringing. Okay. That's how it works, amazing as it is. What does that mean? It means that awareness operationally in the nervous system is the representing capacity of the nervous system to represent. And in particular, to represent to itself in a kind of recursive way. Because most of the information that's represented in the nervous system is outside of awareness. This means that there is this ongoing representing capacity that has excess capacity. There must be grout between the tiles, if you will, of the contents arising and passing away in the stream of consciousness. And you can start to have an intuition, even a direct sense, of this ongoing representing capacity, right, which is itself never disturbed by what it represents. You can find a peace in that awareness itself. That was pretty conceptual, but you see what I'm getting at? You know, and it's trippy to realize, wow, representing fertile chaos, fertile noise, ongoingness, at least as long as this body keeps on going, awareing is ongoing. You know, like imagine a TV screen with a lot of white noise, just total static, right? TV screen from your perspective. And then suddenly an image comes along. You've got mail or something, you know? Or a picture of a banana and then it's gone again, or it coalesces out of the fertile noise and then it goes back into it. I had a professor at UCLA a long time ago. He would do a very interesting thing. He would take a slide of an image, like a herd of zebras, right? Or a flower in a stream, something. And he would start it out totally blurred. And then he would very, very slowly sharpen it. And he'd say, observe your mind at around the moment of perception. And then there'd be this moment, herd of zebras. But if you watch that event, it usually takes at least several tenths of a second to form, you know, what that is in the knowing. It's like a pattern emerging. And then, let's suppose he goes on to the next image, which is blurred, then it goes away. Again, awareness as a process is like that screen with a lot of static, a lot of fertile noise, you know, through which images emerge and then they decay back into it again. But there's an ongoingness of that process. This, again, conceptual, but it's a way into, wow, that is what my body is doing. I mean, to come into an intimacy of, that's actually what this process of experiencing living is in a deep way. Now I'm really going to go all the way out.
Yeah. Is what you're saying,
yeah,
that the white, let's just say the white noise, is that the piece?
Great question. There is something about it that feels peaceful. You know, whether it's the gap between the thoughts or even the witness, but people talk about the space of awareness. That's another way into it. It's the idea that awareness is like a space. In Tibet, they'll talk about the sky. It's boundless because it has no edge to it, you know. And you can start to, when your mind especially is pretty quiet, you're kind of just hanging out. And awareness itself is just really quiet, and then something appears and goes away. And there's a very background sense of ongoing being, but what's really prominent is that awareness itself is just itself peaceful. That's kind of what I'm getting at. And again, it's to be experienced ultimately, but these are kind of, if you will, suggestions, pointing out instructions. But I definitely want to get to the last one, okay? So the last one is what I'll call enjoying the peace in, pardon me, what's unchanging. Now, isn't this ironic that in a Buddhist framework, in which, you know, usually the first of the three characteristics of existence that's named is impermanence, right? I want to talk about what's unchanging. And there are different ways to get into this notion of what's unchanging. I'm going to do three levels to it, right? So the first kind of what's unchanging is, you could say, fairly straightforward. 2 + 2 is always 2 + 2. That's unchanging. Right? The fact that 20 years ago you did something nice for someone, or you accomplished something significant, or in your little league playoffs at the bottom of the ninth, you know, when the evil team from out of town, full of bullies, right, you still hit that home run or something or other that won the game. Wahoo. No one can take that away from you. It'll never change that has happened. The fact that things change doesn't change, for example, right? Or a recognition about yourself that, at least in this life, there can be a recognition that you are basically a good person. You're not a perfect person, you don't always manifest your goodness, but you can take refuge in the unchanging truth that you are basically a good person, for example. Those are things that don't change. Okay, we can find a peace in that, we can count on it, we can take refuge in it. Right? The deeper level of the unchanging is allness itself. In other words, to use a metaphor that's commonly used of waves in the ocean, okay? So we are, in some sense, individual waves. We arise and pass away for a time. During our cresting, we have a unique identity. This wave that's cresting here is different from the wave next to it, which is really different from the wave in the Indian Ocean, which is different from the wave in the Arctic, right? And you could get into the detail of this, you know, the particular pattern of lacy foam on the wave and the fact that this wave is taller than that wave and all the rest of that. But eventually, the waves return to that which they are an expression of, the ocean altogether. But ocean as ocean never itself changes. Allness as allness never itself changes. If you think of the universe, whatever you encompass in allness, including wild stuff in the material universe, let alone whatever else you want to throw in there, spooky stuff, supernatural, clairvoyance, disincarnate entities, Brahma realms, you know, whatever allness is, allness as allness isn't changing. And you can actually kind of start experiencing that, especially again as things quiet increasingly. You can have an intuition of connectedness. You know, yes, you are this wave sitting here rather than that wave sitting there or sitting there, but you're really extending into allness. Your mind is extending out into the stimuli that are producing it. You're extending out into the causes and conditions that manifest as this moment of thought or feeling or sound. You're extending out into the human species conditioned through evolution and so forth. Extending out into human culture that's also conditioning whatever is arising in this moment. And then extending out further into light. You know, when we eat food, if we eat plants, unless they're mushrooms, they're congealed sunlight, basically, you know. That goes all the way out. We're breathing stardust, all that stuff. And ultimately, it's the whole flipping universe, 13.7 years after it just kind of blinked into existence. What was with that? Anyway, you can just kind of get that. Wow. And allness itself, the whole deal, never changes as the whole deal. See what I mean? Things change in it. Waves change. But ocean as ocean never itself changes. And then there is what the Buddha called through various names, which is given people conniption fits ever since, the unconditioned or the deathless. And I want to read you two passages and then open it up to conversation, okay? And the key point about all this is you could take what I'm saying as kind of cool, if you like, statements about what, right? But the way I really invite you to relate to what I'm talking about here is in terms of the how of practice, you know, as skillful means. See how this might be skillful means for you to enjoy one or more of these kinds of peace. Right. So the quotations. The first one, as best we know, was something that the Buddha said to a benefactor, a patron, who was coming to visit the Buddha early in one morning after the Buddha had finished his morning meditation. Just making sure I'm still recorded here. And the visitor was startled by the Buddha and said to the Buddha, essentially, I trust you're well, noble sir. You know, very respectful, India 2,500 years ago. I find you well. And I trust I find you at ease. And the Buddha replied, says, indeed the sage who's fully quenched, which means the fires that fuel suffering have been put out. That's a synonym for nirvana, the blowing out. Indeed the sage who's fully quenched rests at ease in every way. No sense desire adheres to him or her whose fires have cooled, deprived of fuel. All attachments have been severed. The heart's been led away from pain. Tranquil, he or she rests with utmost ease. The mind has found its way to peace. You can kind of get a feeling of that. And then where he really goes for it, when we're talking now about this deeper substrate, because that's what nirvana is technically in Buddhism. It is a transformative recognition of the unconditioned. That you could say there are other profound realizations that are deeply important for people, and there are realizations outside the frame of Buddhism that are, to me, deeply powerful, and I have enormous respect for them, that are in more theistic traditions, if you will, God realization, things like that. And still, in Buddhism, the essence of nirvana is some kind of transformative experience of the unconditioned, okay, which he then talks about a little more here. And by its very nature, the unconditioned, all you can do is kind of vaguely point in that direction. So there's a limitation in language, thus the use of metaphor and poetry. So here the Buddha says, there is that dimension or realm or sphere. Where there is neither earth, nor water, nor fire, nor wind. In other words, the four elements that constitute everything in this reality are not present at all. Earth, water, fire, and wind in the Hindu tradition of his time. There is neither earth, nor water, nor fire, nor wind. Neither dimension of the infinitude of space, nor dimension of the infinitude of consciousness, nor dimension of nothingness, nor dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. And some of you may recognize that he's speaking there about the four formless jhanas, the highest mystical attainments of the teachers of his age. He's basically saying there's something beyond even in the infinitude of space, the infinitude of consciousness, the dimension of nothingness, and even the last one of the eight, the last of the four formless jhanas, nor dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. Neither this world, nor the next world, nor sun, nor moon. And there, I say, there is neither coming, nor going, nor staying. Neither passing away, nor arising. No change. Unestablished, unevolving, not based on conditions. Unestablished, unevolving, without support. This, just this, is the end of suffering. Okay. Any feelings or thoughts? Emily.
I'm so excited by this one phrase that I feel like I want to just clarify from understanding the power that when you said there was the excess capacity in the, and I'm hearing you say actual, the brain's actual physical mechanism, that there's excess capacity for representing and creating.
Yes, yes, and if I follow you right, that excess capacity allows us to learn a new phone number. You know, fairly prosaic, it allows us to realize that, you know, the bathroom's down that hall, not that hall, you know what I mean? As well as that excess capacity allows us, of course, to learn or grow and so forth. So I'm not trying to make the excess capacity itself mystical. It itself doesn't necessarily draw us in a good direction. But from a practical practice standpoint, an intuition of that kind of freedom, in a sense, this goes to something related, the sense of that capacity that's not yet conditioned, the experience or the intuition or even a kind of a felt recognition of the as yet unconditioned neural substrates that are quivering in fertile noise, just waiting to cohere into something organized to represent some experience. And then they relax out into the next fertile possibility. Our sense of that unconditioned, waiting to be conditioned when we have a thought or a sound, that coalition is now patterned. It's still fairly dynamic because it's decaying as new synapses are enlisted in it, even during the second or two or three of the conscious experience, all right? But our intuition of that relatively unconditioned representing capacity of awareness, I think, can be a kind of intuition into the as yet unconditioned manifesting capacity of reality at every instant just prior to quantum potentiality congealing into actuality. And if you want to see my essay on eddies in the stream, I think one reason why Nibbana can be transformative is that there's a profound quieting of the mind, if you follow the progression through the four jhanas, the form jhanas, and then the four formless. When you're out at the last one, neither perception nor non-perception, you know, after nothingness, that's pretty quiet. The signals have really dropped out. And the body's not dead. Those neurons are still alive. They're metabolizing and signaling each other. They're not signaling, they're metabolizing and firing. But it's just about nothing but fertile noise. And I think in that moment, there's this radical penetrating insight into unconditionality. The insight is into the unconditionality of the animal body mind, which takes you into some radically transformative recognition of the profound unconditionality in reality, just prior to reality manifesting. That's my notion. Time to go. I'm really sorry.
So just
simply,
I found it very liberating. But so what you just described, is that awareing? I like the word you used, awareing. Yeah. We're constantly awareing, but these kind of breaks in between awareing.
Yeah. Well, I'd say that in that, when you do that little experiment like, you know, there is a banana, just before you think that thought, right? There is that kind of space in there. Yeah, it's aware. There is an awareing going on. There is awareness. You haven't gone unconscious in the space between the thoughts. Yeah.
And so does meditation help you relax in between?
Yeah. I think that's what happens. You know, it kind of goes to, I think at a practical level, we've all experienced this. When we're really upset about something, it's like the thoughts are very densely connected to each other. And then somebody says something, or we just take a little break, and it's as if there's a little space between them, or we start budging away from our own experience. That's an experience, that little bit of space, you know? Or Sokhne Rinpoche says, the problem is not that we have thoughts, it's that we glue them together. You know, we lose sight of the grout. We got the tiles all jammed up, you know? And I think also we often might have an experience as we especially relax. Even the grout itself starts to get a little less stable. Now, don't do this if you're vulnerable to psychosis, all right? Not a good idea, right? Be aware of this. But if you're okay, if you can go through it, yeah, you can kind of relax and let it get more fizzy, okay? Great. Great.
I don't know if this makes any sense, but I have to ask you. So if awareness is unknowing, the grout is awareness, right?
Yeah, in my metaphor. Yeah.
And that's an unknowing place. You said that.
That's you're pointing out, I think, a fuzziness in how I was speaking. So I'm going to try to clarify it a little bit. So I'll just say, good.
So then where does the truth come from?
What do you mean truth?
Knowing the truth.
So if
I guess I was making the leap from awareness being unknowing, and then.
Uh-huh.
Knowing the truth, is that coming from awareness? Is that coming from that space? Truth. That's all I want to know.
Okay. Well, if I follow you, okay. If I get you right, so in the way I'm using it, well, to operationalize it in, you know, to kind of bring it down to something concrete as a coalition of synapses, you know, but kind of at that level. I define awareness in a way as an aspect of the representing capacity of the nervous system, okay? And it's an ongoing representing. We are preoccupied with that which is represented, right? The knowledge of where the cookie is, or the worry, or the sensation in the body. That's what's represented. But we often lose sight of the representing process, right? That's what I'm kind of getting at. And I'm kind of giving different ways to find peace in the representing process. And part of the, where I fuzzed my language, and I appreciate it because you're getting me to sharpen it. I think when you recognize this as it were space between the thoughts, you're conscious and there's no representing in that little space. So you could even argue that's a little bit of at odds with the Buddha's claim that consciousness always has an object. But it does seem as if there are these little gaps where you're still conscious. You're aware that there's no content between the thought. There is, just before you think there is a banana, and especially just after you think there is a banana, you know, it's as if there's a little, like a hiccup before the next content arises, right? And I'm saying that you're still aware there, but there's no content. That's a way to sense that, okay, right? And then what is truth? Well, there are different kinds of truth, you know, that like go on the green light. I mean, that's a kind of truth, right? So I personally am a little reluctant to sentimentalize awareness. And I think that's kind of a trap in practice to reify it and attach to it. And what's called valorize it, make it special, you know. I'm a little leery of that because the awareness that is aware of the great realization is aware of the good idea. Oh, let's bomb them back into the Stone Age. You know what I mean? It's like, its awareness can represent just about anything. It's like this TV screen can represent bananas or other things, right? And so, on the other hand, there is something, especially in our content-saturated age, that's deeply peaceful about that space between the tiles in the mosaic of the stream of consciousness, if you will. And I think that's a way into a more peaceful place where we feel less demanded upon, at least in that moment. What a relief, right? When the mind is quiet. Oh my God, you know, it's like, ugh. And though, I will say that I do think that that recognition of awareness itself is a doorway into certain kinds of profoundly useful truth, profoundly important truth, profound truth. I think it's a doorway into non-clinging, because awareness itself doesn't cling to what it represents. You can get a feeling of that. And awareness itself has a kind of stillness. What it represents is changing. But the awareness feels like the screen is still and stuff moves across it. Kind of. And then in this ultimate way, I think it's quite interesting. It's called a homologue. There's a similarity in the nature of the unconditioned, fertile noise in the brain that's just waiting to represent the next content coming through. There's an equivalence in the nature of that that's effectively unconditioned. It's not yet unconditioned. There's a parallel between that and, I think, quantum unconditionality just always prior to quantum actuality, which is the substrate or basis of the material universe, which includes energy, E equals mc squared. So in that sense, I think going down way deep in awareness can be a transformative door. Now, more prosaically, all right, wrapping up here, there is enjoying the peace of relief. Lay down your burdens. Rick, lay down your to-do list, right? Whatever that is, you know? Feed the body. Be at peace with your neighbors. Step out of the quarrel. You know, the Buddha says, those who recognize they will die settle their quarrels. You know, that's a good point. There is that kind of peace. And be true to what the body being needs. It needs safety. It needs fulfillment. It needs connection, you know, right? Pet the lizard, feed the mouse, hug the monkey. My thing about that, okay? Also, tranquility. Appreciate the importance of tranquilizing the bodily formations, right? Those are reachable. even without the third and fourth that I've named here. Those first two are available in daily life, all right? Sudden awakening, gradual cultivation, sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. We have a sense of them. We take in the good. We help them land. We gradually make them more and more the habit of our life. And then, of course, awareness. You know, awareness as the witness, awareness as this kind of space between content, and maybe even more deeply, an intuition of awareness as this kind of ongoing representing process or space in which things come and go, right? That's pretty available to us. And then if it's real for you, and it's been really the edge of my personal practice, I call it emptying out into allness. You know, to kind of, it's experiential. You sort of, it's based on a recognition that allness is true. And so you can kind of trust it. You're not kidding yourself, but you're sort of relaxing and opening out into it. And then using that, if it can take you to this intuition, like initially it maybe is conceptual, but it starts getting more like, whoa, your mind starts feeling more and more lacy, and there's some sense of this unconditionality also in the mix. That's good practice. Let's sit for a minute and wrap it up. I mean, even right now, you might have a sense, like I am, you know, the mind being a little agitated on the surface, just thinking, conceptualizing, holy moly. You know, but somehow through it or underneath it or in which it arises, there is something that just feels deeply still, deeply peaceful. Enjoy.
Thank you, Rick.
Take it easy, everybody. See you next week. Enjoy your peace.